Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening.
This is Dr. Daniels, and welcome to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul. Oh, boy. We are broadcasting from Panama, which is in the middle of a torrential storm. So, if there are quality issues with this broadcast, we will be posting a better quality audio on the website at vitalitycapsule.com, and it's in the replay section. Okay, so having said that, we can proceed. Today's topic is the count. The count. We are literally going to do a body count so people can understand where this number, 860,000 deaths per year at the hands of medical care, comes from. So what I did just for tonight, just for you, is I did a recount. Yes, I did a recount. And when I did a recount, we counted the hospital deaths, outpatient deaths, and nursing home deaths, and we counted Medicare patients and non-Medicare patients. When you add all of that up, the count, the new count, 988,000 deaths. And this, again, is in 2012, 2013. Why? Because more recent figures are not available. But I have to say I was very surprised to find that there was some 2013 data available, although I was disappointed that the Medicare Inspector General did not update 2010 figures. So let's get started. You guys know the show involves actually a fair amount of technology. And many screens open all at once. Okay, so how did I get involved in this? What got me thinking about this? The first awareness, and it's just kind of a glimmer, kind of a just a little vibration of sensing something was wrong. This was back in the year of our Lord, 1980. And I was a young medical student, and we were doing rounds, and there was this group of people. They weren't doctors, they weren't nurses, they weren't quite administrators. I wasn't really sure what they were, but they were in charge of keeping the patient safe. Well, I kind of took offense at that. Well, here where I was trained to be a doctor, and of course, I was the ultimate guardian of my patient's safety because everything doctors did was to benefit the patient. This was my naive 23-year-old mind. And so this committee officiously went from bed to bed looking under the patient's heels and writing notes and moving on to the next bed. I said, I wonder what they're doing. So I said to the senior doctor, what are they doing? The senior doctor said, well, they're checking for bed sores. I said, oh, well, what does that mean? Well, bed sores are a major cause of death. I said, bed sores? Death? Interesting. Then they got the whole, speech. First, the patient's laying in bed. They have pressure in one spot. The area gets red. And then from getting red, the skin begins to thin from the pressure because the person can't turn. The skin then breaks open, and there we are. We have an open wound, doesn't heal, and the patient ultimately dies because ordinary bacteria all around us that don't bother regular healthy people because their skin is not broken gets into the blood of these people, and they die. I said, oh. So, of course, this is back in the old ages, the dark ages, actually 1980s. So what we would do is we were taught about all kinds of things, soft booties to put on people's heels. There's always a Clinitron bed for several thousand dollars. We could, put the person in a Clinitron bed. That was frowned upon because it increased the cost of health care. But that was the first I was aware that people were dying just because they were in the hospital. These same patients, if they were not in the hospital, they would be home, and they would be moving around or moving from bed to chair. Maybe their relatives would be taking them places, getting them dressed, doing all kinds of things with them, but they're in the hospital. Not the case. And so they get a bed sore, it gets infected, and they die. So that was my first inkling in medical school. But, of course, we were told that's why as doctors we had to be very careful who we admit to the hospital and only admit people for whom the benefits were more than the risk. Okay. And so you will be interested to know probably that bed sores from being in the hospital causes 60,000 deaths per year. 60,000. Where did I get this number from? It's outrageous. Well, I got it from the AHRQ website. This is a .gov website. Yes, the government has been counting. And the count, the bed sore count, is 60,000 deaths per year. This is in the year, 2011. That's the count for bed sores. Not a very glamorous way to go. But it happens. So now we have to take a look at our other counts. I mentioned before to you that Medicare did an audit, the Inspector General in 2010, and he determined that 15,000 Medicare patients per month were being murdered in the hospital under the watchful eye, of course, of Medicare, with the visits being paid for by Medicare. Now, the evaluation done by the Inspector General was, of course, evaluated, as you might imagine. And it was evaluated by the Journal of Patient Safety. And what they determined was that the Medicare method used, which is they basically flagged suspicious cases, was actually only 78% sensitive. What does that mean, 78% sensitive? And Jackie Downer, there you go, those big numbers. That means that the 180,000 deaths per year only detected 78% of the deaths. So if we take that 180,000 divided by 0.78, the real number of Medicare deaths is 230,000 a year. And so we can take that as a pretty hard number because we took a look at their report. Now, the Medicare report focused on errors like errors in medication and did not focus so much on other logistical things. So the Medicare report, even though we can guess that the 180,000 per year number really only represents 78% of the Medicare people who died, closer to 230,000, for the indicators that they looked for. And so we find out by looking at evaluations of that study, that actually there was a lot that the study did not take a look at. So let's understand what patient harm is. This area is so well studied that they even have a whole cadre of three-letter abbreviations and euphemisms. So what we're talking about is PAEs. That's patient adverse event. So when you go to the hospital, you can throw around a term, well, we don't want to have any PAEs, do we? And people will, the eyebrows will raise and they'll realize, oh my God, we better not kill this one. So PAE is what's called a patient adverse event, and it haunts patients. And this particular report in Patient Safety Magazine said, these are frighteningly common in this highly technical, rapidly changing, poorly integrated industry. And, of course, it's complicated by, get this, a lack of transparency, which means secrecy. Patients are not told. Patients need a lot of secrecy. And limited accountability for errors. That means there's no punishment for errors that harm patients. Most of the times when patients are harmed, it goes totally undetected, hence totally unpunished. But even if detected, the punishment is what? That a third party called an insurance company, a malpractice company, might hand money to the relatives of the deceased. In other words, the person causing the harm is not inconvenienced. So there are many types of harm. And they mentioned 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 categories of harm. Unfortunately, our present methods of detecting harm only detect one of these 5 categories. So let's see what these categories are. First category of harm is commission. This is easy to detect. You read the medical record and you say, oh my God, I can't believe the doctor did that. And you see that what the doctor did, whether it's prescribing a medication, nicking an artery, ordering a dangerous, unnecessary test, and the patient dies of the complication of, say, a dye reaction. These are errors of commission. Something was done. So these are easy, very easy to detect. Another type of error usually goes undetected is an error of omission. These are almost never detected. Error of omission means something was not done. And this is something that's difficult to detect. For example, if a person has a lung infection that they die of, the lung infection could be a complication of a spleen removed 20 years earlier. And this error would never be detected because the person would be admitted for pneumonia. Maybe they would get treatment, antibiotics, fluids, maybe some steroids, and they would die. And there would be no evidence in that chart that the care rendered created or was in part responsible for the death of the patient on that particular day. So these errors of omission, or I should say as it were the effect is delayed, in a particular example, it was believed that the lack of a pneumococcal vaccine might have caused the death. And so that would be an error of omission. And these are generally not usually detected. Next error not detected usually is error of communication. And this is an error where the doctor could reasonably realize the patient is at risk for something, not inform the patient, and then the patient goes on to die. The example given in my research was a cardiologist finds that a person is prone to having fainting attacks. Person happens to be a runner and doesn't tell the person, hey, don't run. Person's discharged, goes running, and drops dead while running. And so there's a lot of errors of communication. I think the biggest error of communication, of course, is informing patients of their true probability of benefiting from a particular course of therapy. That's a huge error of communication. It's often not communicated very well. Next is an error of context. This is actually pretty huge. An error of context would be recommending a birth control pill for someone who's already had a hysterectomy. In the context of that, the person has no uterus, cannot possibly get pregnant. So the context is, of course, it would be inappropriate. Another error of context is for a physician to advise a patient to take sitz baths when maybe the patient hasn't got a bathtub or any way to take a sitz bath. And so these errors of context are just very, very, they're really quite frequent because the standard of care is not sensitive to context. And so if a doctor is following a standard of care protocol, there's no place in the protocol that says, well, wait, stop, back up, look at the context. No, it doesn't happen. there's stuff to be filed, and that is it. I'll give you an example. After my third baby, I went to the OBGYN the next day. I had the baby at home. So I went the next day because there was some bleeding. I figured I needed a couple of stitches down there. So sure enough, I did need a couple of stitches. So I put in a few stitches. And he says, well, what are you going to do for birth control? I said, birth control? He said, yes. You don't want to get pregnant again, do you? I said, well, I get pregnant by artificial insemination. Man, I just won't order a sperm tank. And then I won't get pregnant. That's all. Oh, my God. He threw up his hands. Ran out of the room. I said, don't come back. Get out of my office. So a lot of errors of context. Now, that particular error of context wasn't a problem because, of course, I refused the birth control pills, so I didn't get to have a blood clot or heart attack. But this is huge. Then, of course, there are diagnostic errors. This is a very large category. This one is exploding modern day. It's exploding because of the screening programs and the high false positive rate. And so when we say diagnostic error, a lot of you think, I go to the doctor, I have a headache, and he misses my brain tumor. That's not usually what happens. Usually what happens is you feel just fine, and you decide, oh, my God, they're having this five-point screening program down at the mall. I'm going to go get an echocardiogram and get my blood pressure checked and then get Doppler on my legs, make sure my venous flow is okay, and get a bone density and get all these things in one place, all five of them. But what the public does not know is getting five screening tests simply increases your chances of a false positive, and then it's the treatment of these false positives that is now becoming a growing factor in murder by medicine. And so diagnostic error leads to harm from errors of commission by overtreatment of the patient and the apparent eagerness of the U.S. healthcare industry to overdiagnose patients often leads to harmful consequences for patients. So this is so significant that the Journal of Patient Safety, you know, this is what they said about this. Now, the other shocking thing they mentioned is this is the journal that reviewed the Medicare Inspector General's report and determined that 78%, at most, 78% of events were captured. And also that many of these captured events were of only a certain type, and certain types were not captured. So in other words, the Medicare report tended not to capture the pulmonary venous thromboembolism, and this is a complication of bed rest, which is common in hospitals. And it did not catch procedure-related errors because their triggers or screening criteria didn't catch those. And so the Medicare report leaned more heavily towards medication errors. And so that is very interesting. And there are studies on people of different ages. For example, one large study which showed a murder rate of 1.1% per admission. That's pretty high. So 1.1% of people admitted who are an average of 58 years old ended up dying. I'm sorry, it's the Journal of Health Affairs, not the Journal of Patient Safety, the Journal of Health Affairs. So this is shocking. So a non-Medicare patient has a 1.1% chance of dying in the hospital as a result of the medical care they received. A Medicare patient has a 1.4% chance of dying in the hospital as a result of the care that they received. And they even did a study in hospitals in North Carolina. And they picked North Carolina because North Carolina had a 96% hospital participation rate where hospitals were actively reducing their murder rates. And in North Carolina, they found that the murder rate was 0.6%. So 0.6% of people who came to the hospital hoping to get better, seeking help and assistance, died just because they were admitted to the hospital. So let's take a second look at more causes of death. We got bed sores. Okay, easy beans. Hospital infections. This is curious. Now, many of you know that this really is something I'm just totally ticked and miffed about. If you will recall, the hospital infection rate was 99,000 as of 2012. And the cause of these hospital infections, most of them are resistant, antibiotic-resistant infections, we know to be antibiotics in the food supply. In other words, the antibiotics in the food supply create resistant bugs. The person goes to the hospital. They get the needles. They get the tubes. The tubes spread the bugs into a place in the body where the immune system cannot handle it, and the person drops dead and go. So that's not good. However, the government has taken a second look at this, because apparently I'm not the only one that's totally miffed at this. A lot of people were very upset. They found it totally unacceptable. So what did the government do? They instituted a surveillance program. It started in 2013, because 99,000 is a 2012 number. So in 2013, what they did was they started a surveillance program, and they rigorously defined a resistant infection. And they excluded quite a few cases. So if you have a antibiotic-resistant infection and you die in the hospital, the death is not necessarily attributed to the hospital-acquired or the antibiotic-resistant infection. And so that is a big change. And this classification has its classification change has lowered the number from 99,000 to 38,000. I'm going to be generous. I'm going to use the 38,000 figure. How about that? So these are hospital-acquired infections and antibiotic-resistant infections is the bulk of these. Now, the important thing to understand about these antibiotic-resistant infections is they can only occur in the presence of an antibiotic. An antibiotic is a medication. Therefore, by definition, any antibiotic-resistant infection is a result of medical intervention, if you consider a drug like an antibiotic to be a medicine. Now, it could be indirect. In this case, it starts from the meat you eat that's fed antibiotics. It culminates when the doctor either gives you one dose of antibiotics, which is a straw that breaks the camel's back, and boom, you now develop an invasive situation that's life-threatening, or the doctor orders a urinary catheter, which is a tube that's passed into the bladder, and then the bacteria can track into the bladder. There's a little bit of abrasion on the tube. It scrapes off some of the cells, creates an opening in the blood vessels, and bing, in goes the infection. So that's the 38,000 hospital infection. Then we have another category. This is called unnecessary procedures. Now, does the doctor say to the patient, oh, I would like to recommend an unnecessary procedure. Do you think we should go ahead with this? Why don't we go ahead and do this unnecessary surgery? No, absolutely not. The patient's totally unaware. And who gets these unnecessary procedures? Well, people with insurance, of course, and the financial ability to pay, the deductibles, co-pays, and so on. And so unnecessary procedures are an extreme hazard to the, let's just say, well-to-do. Those of you who are into class conflict and warfare, the 1%. So the nation's 1% not only have all these other hazards to deal with, but they have the unnecessary procedures to deal with because people who have the capacity to pay are targeted for these unnecessary procedures. In fact, the United States government was investigating one of the major hospital chains for giving doctors incentives to do unnecessary surgeries on patients. And in medical school, we were taught the best patient, best surgical candidate is the person who does not need the surgery. Okay, so that's 37,000. Those of you who got a pencil there at home, you can write that down. And we're going to get our grand total in a few. Well, the next thing is outpatients. This is shocking. Outpatients. These are people who didn't go near a hospital. All they did was go to the doctor. And, of course, follow doctor's orders. that's an important part of Murder by Medicine, is following doctor's orders. So it's important to realize these outpatient deaths are extremely preventable. In the hospital, generally the person is on their back. Maybe they've been drugged with sleeping pills or pain pills. They're in an altered and defenseless state. So we can say, well, you know, the person in the hospital was really, really defenseless. But the outpatient, he has to give his all. He's got to participate in this murderous ordeal. So how do outpatients die? It just so happens in my family. I got a call last night from my frantic mother and, of course, my sister. They had a mother-daughter visit to the doctor. And so mom went to the doctor because she has this open sore on her leg that does not seem to want to heal. Of course, I told mom what to do about this, right? This was months ago. I said, Mom, get the crap out of your intestines. That's number one. Number two, you know, just eat some clean vegetables. Three, you take some gelatin supplement, gives you all the building blocks your body needs to knit together and make a nice new layer of skin for you, and take a little bit of boron. Mom says, well, you know, I'm going to go see the doctor. Okay, so mom goes to the doctor. It's important to know that mom is 83 years old. She goes to see the doctor, and the doctor's actually a friend of the family. So she goes to see the doctor, and she says, I have this wound that's opening up. And the way mom sees it is the slightest little crack, get out your magnifying glass, the slightest little crack, let's catch this early. Mom's not one to let things go. I mean, a stitch in time saves nine. I've heard that many times growing up. She goes to see the doctor for this this ulcer. And he's an old-time guy, so he uses an Una boot, which is an elaborate, messy clay plaster paste thing. He wraps it around the ulcer, and then, of course, gives her instructions, but she can't possibly follow on how to wrap it herself. And then he says, oh, by the way, you have high cholesterol, 83 years old. Cholesterol is 240-something. Here, I'm going to recommend Lipitor. He writes her a prescription for Lipitor. Then he says, he checks her blood sugar and does a hemoglobin A1C. Hemoglobin A1C is 6.4. Those of you who are into what's normal, 6.4 is considered normal for diabetics who are under treatment. In other words, if you're a competent doctor exercising tight control, then you are urged to keep the patient's hemoglobin A1C under 7, even though hemoglobin A1Cs at this level, under 7, are known to cause an increase in something called dead-in-bed syndrome. So he writes mom a prescription for a diabetic pill. He did, by the way, check her blood sugar, and it was a random, and it was 145. And so, I don't know why mom gave me a call, but she did. And she says, well, I just want to get rid of my ulcer, that's all. What about all these other drugs? I said, well, mom, you know, if you take that Lipitor, you've got a 10% chance of getting a stroke in the next year. And it does take 1,250 years of use for you to prevent a heart attack. And elevated cholesterol in your age group is associated with living longer. She says, wow, I just won't take that then. I said, mom. And then she said, well, will they know if I don't feel it? I said, I think they will, mom, because these records are computerized. So be sure if anyone asks you to tell them that you're praying on it. She says, oh, okay, yes, I'll do that. I said, what about this diabetes pill? I said, well, mom, since your hemoglobin A1C is already in the tight control range, then adding a diabetes-lowering pill to your present situation is likely to make you a candidate for dead-in-bed syndrome. That means you go to bed and you wake up dead, or I should say you're dead by morning. Well, mom says, well, I'm just not going to take that. I said, that's okay, mom. Just remember, you're praying on it. And so mom decides she's not going to take any of that stuff. And she didn't like the Una boots. They're all messy and gooey. She's going back to her pressure stockings. And yes, she was going to take the supplement. He said, now, where do I get this gelatin? I said, Mom, I shipped you 6 canisters of gelatin about a year ago. Oh, yeah. I said, they're red. And she found them. Took her about 30 seconds. Yeah, I was wondering what to do with these. I said, well, now you know. Take a tablespoon, put it in some water, a pint of water, drink it down, and it'll help that heal right over. He said, okay. So that's exactly the mechanism whereby 199,000 people every year die, and get murdered. Not everyone can just call up Dr. Daniels. Yeah, right. So Mom said, well, Jennifer, do you think that doctor is a little, well, incompetent? I said, you... and Mom told her that I was a better doctor than he was. I said, Mom, he still has a license. Obviously, he's doing his job. He's doing a very good job of it. Your decision is to decide if this is the kind of activity you want to be a part of. And so I don't think it's reasonable to call this person incompetent. In fact, that is a tragedy, that this person is not incompetent. This is a person who's following the medical protocol. So if people want to find out more about being able to call the doc and find out what's up, go to vitalitycapsules.com and check out a discovery session. And we actually are developing, working on a health assurance program. So hit us up, and we'll let you know about it. I'll keep you on the list. Okay. So 199,000, that's a lot. But you know what? 313 million Americans, and so 199,000. That's actually pretty reasonable. Nursing home malnutrition, we just had to toss that in there. What the heck? Only 4,600 people a year. Not bad. In fact, we can almost forgive that. Now, I want to put this in context. You know, 9/11, 3,000 people died in 9/11. And this caused a 10-year war with 1 million Iraqis dead and, you know, several thousand U.S. troops dead. And that was our reaction, and $1 trillion in U.S. resources poured into that. It seems to me it might be reasonable to turn some attention to hospitals or to the healthcare system. Okay, but it doesn't stop there. It's even better. Okay, so next is the Medicare report. Medicare report by the Inspector General. Documents 180,000 dead. And again, this only detected 78%, so we take 180,000 divided by 0.78, we get 230,000 is a true number of Medicare unfortunates that because they had Medicare insurance, because they went to the hospital, they suffered this fate of murder by medicine, 230,000. Again, this is quite a bit larger than the number who died in the 9/11 issue. And if we're talking about, you know, saving American lives, this is definitely an area worthy of attention. Now, the Medicare report focused mainly on drug errors. It did not focus on surgical errors. It did not focus on antibiotic-resistant infections. So it's 230,000 deaths in Medicare patients. Then we have just hospital error in general. This hospital error in general is 420,000, and this is shocking. Well, this hospital error report, they attempted to capture the 5 categories of error: the omission, errors of omission, communication, context, and diagnostic errors, and they went all out to find these. And what they found was that they could attribute 420,000 deaths per year just due to, they call it hospital error, but I prefer to call it hospital events, because whether it's a mistake or not is certainly open to debate. And I'm sure many of these actions are clearly defensible according to the standard of care. In fact, in the Medicare report, they were very clear that they believed at least 50% to 60% of these deaths were unavoidable, even though the deaths were caused by the medical care received. They did not represent mistakes or errors at all. So, now, the grand total of using, keeping track with your sharp pencil, is 988.6 thousand deaths a year. That's a lot of carnage. And basically, what that says is that the healthcare system in the United States kills about as many Americans in 1 year as our military killed in Iraq in 10 years, which I find to be pretty shocking. I mean, the healthcare system is darned efficient, you know, by that measure. It's pretty pretty impressive. Now, people, I didn't give the call-in number for the program. If people have questions, they can call in at 914-338-0695, 914-338-0695, and we'll be taking questions in about 5 minutes. Okay, so this is really very, very interesting. I think the take-home message here is that the issue of murder by medicine is not an isolated issue. In other words, some people say, well, I'm not going to the hospital. If you're not going to the hospital, that's nice, but you're still not safe. There's still the outpatient issue. There's still a nursing home issue. There's still many other ways to die by murder by medicine. So simply avoiding hospitals is not an adequate strategy. The other thing people say is, well, I just won't take medication. And again, sounds nice. But unfortunately, people do things like call 911, and they call ambulances, and then they're off to the races. And the emergency room has the highest kill rate of any other part of the hospital. I mean, in terms of kill rate, it is the highest valued real estate in the hospital. The emergency room is the absolute worst place to enter the hospital. So the real deal is to get a plan in place where you eliminate the medical industrial complex from your plan of healing. Now, many people say, oh, you know, I thought I was going to die. If you really believe in your heart that you're going to die, you should not go to the hospital because the hospital is only going to increase your chances of dying. If you really believe you're going to die, your best chance is to stay at home, drink some water, and wait it out. Take your chances. Throw yourself literally in the mercy of God. You know, let whatever invisible force might be out there, let that heal you. That's one step, and that's if you're not, you know, herbally speaking, sophisticated. And if you are sophisticated, then, you know, have your, you know, have a plan in place where you're going to intervene and help yourself. So it's really, really important to have an alternate plan in place. Now, this carnage, 988,000 people a year, this is a number that's as of 2013. So I had sources that were dated 2013, so we can say pretty current within about a year or so. Now, so this is prior to the implementation of Obamacare, prior to the government generously taxing people to pay for government-administered, government-supervised health care. And so we know what government-supervised health care has done for Medicare patients. You know, every indication, if you look at this murder rate, is that it's shortening their life. You know, they're not surviving this very well. So this is not a one has to seriously question the motives of the government, whoever's making this decision. I mean, maybe the government's not making this decision. Maybe private concerns are making this decision under color of law or under the guise of the fig leaf of government. But whoever is making the decision concerning Obamacare, concerning insurance, concerning the medical industrial complex, the decision to provide insurance, the decision to make hospitals tax exempt, the decision to provide grants to hospitals is one that has, I won't even say hospitals, to the medical industry, that has led to the demise of many Americans. And this is seriously a tragedy. So if you have any questions about that or any comments, whatever, just, you know, call in, hit me up, and we'll chat about it. But it's really important for people to take a firm view of, you know, what's going on. Now, as many of you know, I do write, you know, write some jokes, and I think this is a time, you know, for levity. Even though it's a serious subject, sometimes subjects are so serious you just have to smile at them. So one person, the first person says, it's a first joke, the first person says, it says here that 860,000 Americans die and are murdered by medicine every year. Second person says, nah, can't be true. If there was something wrong, the government would let us know. The next one, the person says, hey, you know, it says here 860,000 Americans are murdered each year at the hands of the medical industry. Second person says, you know, it must be that other United States. It can't be here. And so I think this is the major hazard, is that people believe it's not happening here, or worse, that it can't happen to them. And you need to realize that, yeah, it is happening here in the United States. And, yes, it can happen to you. In fact, if you are educated, if you are employed with insurance, then it's even a more likely chance, a greater chance that it will happen to you. For every one person whose life is saved by medicine, at least 30 are murdered by medicine. So it turns out that you're better off not having the opportunity to be saved by medicine. I'll give you another example. I think I might have mentioned this before. My daughter was playing basketball, injured her knee. Her friend said, oh, my God, you got to go to the emergency room and get that checked out. And besides, you got insurance. Because she's a student at the time. They had, you know, student insurance, whatever. She goes to the emergency room, flashes her student insurance card. Of course, they're totally uninterested in her insurance card for some reason. I guess they knew something she didn't know, which is that her insurance was not going to pay. And so they did an MRI scan, which cost several thousand dollars, and said, you have a torn anterior cruciate ligament, and you must get surgery or you will never walk properly again. Well, thank God she was absolutely poor. She had no money, whatever. And so she says, well, I'll just get a leg brace. So they gave her a leg brace. So she thought they gave her a leg brace, but charged her a few hundred dollars for it and sent her on her way. And so she calls me up in Panama and says, Mom, I need surgery. I need surgery for my anterior cruciate ligament. I said, that's nice. Asked her a few questions. Does it hurt? Can you move it? Da-da-da-da. And she said, well, you know, it hurts a little bit, not much. And, yeah, I can move it, but I can't play basketball on it. I said, okay. Well, you know what? I think that you just need to take it easy for a bit, improve your diet, see how it goes. And this is 3 years later. She did not have the surgery because she never did get a job earning enough money for her to be able to pay for the surgery. And she's able to run 5 miles a day without any limitation at all. Now, had she agreed to the anterior cruciate surgery, she would have been at least, in a low estimate, is 0.6% chance of murder by medicine. And as a person receiving an uncomplicated orthopedic procedure, there's all kinds of things that can happen, chief of which, of course, is infection, then anesthesia complications, and, of course, incidental drug overdose by her getting a medication either she doesn't need or the doctor prescribing, say, a pain pump, and she just clicks the button too many times. So not being able to afford medical care is a huge, huge plus The next plus is simply to be unwilling to pay for medical care, to have a policy that if it's medical care, you're not paying for it. Like some people decide that they're just not going to pay for pornography. They're not going to do it. Not going to do it. It's a policy. And that is the attitude you need to have. You need to have the attitude that you are just not going to pay for it. That if they want to kill you, they're going to have to do it for free. And this is really, really important. So you need to get your budget in line in order and make up your mind that you are not going to pay to be murdered. That if anyone is going to murder you, they're going to have to do it for free. That's it. They're going to have to do it for free. And in the case of murder by medicine, the motive, the immediate motive is money. The immediate motive is people are being murdered for the insurance money. And so if you have insurance, you have literally put a bounty on your head. You literally put a bounty on your head. And so it's important to understand that murder by medicine is a crime. It's an economic crime. In other words, motivation is economic. People do it for economic reasons. And to avoid being murdered by medicine, you need to make yourself economically unattractive. The first step to making yourself economically unattractive is dropping your health insurance. That's number one. Second step to making yourself unattractive, of course, is don't show up. Just don't show up. This is really important. You know, if you have an issue, if something happens, the thing you want to ask yourself is, how can I handle this at home? And the next thing you tell yourself is, you know what? I'm going to wait this out. I'm just going to wait this out. And if you have some money to spend, if you don't want to wait alone, then, you know, you can call up your friends, call up your relatives, throw a party. So, you know, we're going to, you know, come on over, sit with me until things go better. Or, of course, you can check out Discovery Session, VitalityCapsules.com, and we can talk about the possibility of my being available for you to call should something come up. I can't accept everyone into the program, but only so many people because I'm just one person. Future plans are to train more individuals to do what I do, but right now it's only me. So first thing, like I said, no insurance. Second thing, don't show up. Third thing, have a backup plan and have a panic plan. So when something happens that you are totally panicked about, you are totally just unglued, you know, maybe you think it's a stroke, maybe you think it's a heart attack, what should you do? Get a plan for those things. Make a list of everything that you think you might go to the emergency room for. Actually, why don't you send me an email with those things, and I'll make up a program to talk about things to do instead. Sometimes people go to the emergency room, they think they're having a heart attack. Sometimes they think they're having a stroke. Other times they think their belly is going to burst. So the question is, what is it that would push you to go to an emergency room? And that's what you need to focus on, figuring out how you're going to manage those things so that when you panic, you're going to have something else to do, a backup plan. So as I said, the emergency room is the most lethal spot in the hospital and does not appear to be because the people are sicker. Because remember, you have an intensive care unit now, don't you? Yes. And most people who come to the emergency room are not as sick as the people in the intensive care unit. So the issue is to don't panic. Or when you do panic, have a panic plan. So the number for questions is 914-338-0695, 914-338-0695. This is Healing with Dr. Dennis on the Rainbow Soul Channel, Blake Radio Network. And so murder by medicine occurs in a very non-dramatic way. And that's also dangerous. A lot of people expect to hear a drum roll. They expect to hear, negative words and acrimonious exchanges prior to when they're murdered or when the murder is in progress. And unlike hand-to-hand combat, murder by medicine is something that just happens little bit by little bit. When you consider that the murder rate is as high as 1.4%, which is the murder rate for Medicare patients, in a hospital following the standard of care, then there is a 0.25% chance of death per day that the person is in the hospital. It means if you stayed in the hospital for a full year, you would have a 78% chance of dying just because you're in the hospital. And so this death rate is a per-admission death rate. So if you're one person and you get admitted to the hospital four times in the space of a year, then your cumulative risk of death or murder just by hospital, murder by hospital, not by your disease, whatever it may be, but your chances of dying as a result of the hospitalization itself rises to about 5%, so 1.4 times 4. So it's really important to understand that this is a cumulative thing, and this is a serious hazard. Okay, we have a question here. Hi, you're in the air.
Hi, Dr. Daniels.
Yes.
It's so nice to speak with you. The show is really great this evening. But I have a question that's off topic. My sister has what she was told is a wart on her hand, somewhere on her hand. And it's open, and for a while it wouldn't stop bleeding, but then she saw a doctor and they gave her something. I think they're wanting to do surgery. And, of course, I would like to be able to recommend that she could do something else. What could she do?
Well, let's just suppose it's a wart. That's a huge supposition, because warts don't usually break open and bleed. But let's just assume it is a wart. Usually 17.5% salicylic acid. You just put a little drop on there and cover it with duct tape. That's that gray, shiny tape that the American government recommended you tape your house with way back when. So she just applies that, puts the duct tape over it, and changes it every 12 hours. So every 12 hours, take it off and put another drop of salicylic acid on it and cover it. And usually it takes about a week and the wart falls off.
Okay.
Yeah.
Could it be something else?
Yes, it could be something else. In fact, I think most likely it is something else. I think the most likely problem or issue is that she has some type of toxicity, something in her diet or some circumstance she's exposed to, just as an example. If she's a hairdresser, then hairdressers, for example, are exposed to a lot of chemicals. And so hairdressers have a higher incidence of cancer and a lot of other diseases. So she may have an occupational exposure that's causing it. She may have made some dietary change that's causing it. She may be constipated. That might be causing it. So there's a lot of things it could be. But it's an accumulation of substances in her body that her body's trying to get rid of.
Okay. That's wonderful advice. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Okay, that's another example where, one thing is it's a red flag. When a doctor says to you, I don't know what it is, let's do surgery. That's when it's time to say, excuse me, I have some knitting at home. I have to rush back and do my knitting. You know, whatever excuse you can make at that point. If the doctor says, well, I don't know what it is, but let's cut you open. That doesn't work, because with the surgery comes the anesthesia risk. With the surgery comes the risk of antibiotic-resistant infection. And it's just a multitude of things. And then, of course, in this particular case, you have surgery to remove something, which is a result of accumulated toxicity, and then what's going to happen? Of course, the body's going to just make another one. So it doesn't really solve the problem, or worse yet, the body won't make another wart or another lesion in the body, say on the hand or something, but instead the body will say, oh, we're trying to put all the stuff in one place and she won't let us. And we'll spread everything all over the body, and then you have what I call falling apart syndrome. And people describe this as, oh, I just feel like I'm falling apart. So these are very, you know, real issues, and they happen every day. And it's so boring, so unexciting, so banal that people don't realize that they are being set up for murder by medicine. They think it's just another doctor visit. They think it's just another test. They think it's just another surgery. They think the risks outweigh the benefits. But listen to that. The risks outweigh the benefits. What are the risks? Well, the risk is that you could die. Well, what's the benefit? The benefit is the hospital gets paid. The benefit is the doctor gets paid. The benefit is the drug company gets paid. Of course the benefits outweigh the risk. I mean, you're benefiting at least four huge institutions, and the risk is only a risk of one individual. And so the benefits always outweigh the risk. And most patients, when they hear that benefits outweigh the risk, they don't understand what the benefits are or what the risks are. It reminds me of another comic that I wrote. First Lady says, my doctor just prescribed an anti-life pill. And a friend says, well, that sounds pretty dangerous. And the first lady says, well, I'm sure the benefits outweigh the risk. And again, of course, the joke is the benefits do outweigh the risk. But one of the risks, of course, is that the anti-life pill will cause her to, could cause her to die. And antibiotics, that's the English translation, anti-against, biotic is life, so it's anti-life pill. And people are taking anti-life pills all the time, and we know they're dangerous because depending on how you count, somewhere between 99,000 and 38,000 people every year are dying from these anti-life or antibiotic pills. Well, that brings us to the end of today's show, and we'll see you again next week. At Healing with Dr. Daniels. And until then, visit me at vitalitycapsules.com and check out our special. Okay, great.